Welcome to Meet the Professors. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Our faculty for this program includes Dr. Cliff Huddis and Dr. John Mackey for the first session, and Dr. Rowan Schablowski and Dr. Vicente Valero in the second session. The first two cases relate to a common question in clinical practice, adjuvant chemotherapy in the older patient, in this case, two women who were in their late 70s. The first patient was presented by Dr. Leon Dragon.
So this is a 76-year-old woman who presented with a left breast cancer, and she was treated with mastectomy in April of 2005 because of extensive positive margins at lumpectomy. At the time of mastectomy, she had a residual 1.9-centimeter infiltrating ductal carcinoma grade 3 with one of two positive sentinel lymph nodes and 14 additional lymph nodes which were negative. Estrogen receptor was 3+, progesterone receptor was negative, and HER2-new was 2+ by immunohistochemistry and positive by FISH.
Can you talk a little bit more about the woman, her lifestyle, and her comorbidities?
Yes, she was a very nice, deferential European woman, came with her husband. They spoke English, but with some difficulty, and she deferred mostly to her son, who's a general internist, and he really acted as her advocate during the entire discussion of her therapy.
Okay, so we have a very healthy 76-year-old woman who has one positive node and has a HER2-positive, ER-positive, PR-negative tumor. We'll sort of keep that in the back of your mind in terms of how you approach these kinds of patients. And I'll also, at points along this afternoon, ask you all if you have any questions at certain intervals for the faculty. Now, Dr. Dragon, this woman kind of presented in the first trastuzumab window, so to speak, in that it was after the initial presentation or the data came out with the three trials from ASCO, but before December, or before, actually even before that, when the initial data came out with the BCRG-TCH trial. So she presented when the first data came out, but we didn't have the BCRG data. And if you could just, again, before getting into the decision that was made, talk a little bit more about when you discussed the data with her, what her reaction was.
Well, she was very resistant to being treated with chemotherapy. And although she was in excellent health and had really never had any significant medical issues except for some treated hypertension, her son was also very concerned about giving her anthracyclines, and he was aware of the reported interaction with anthracyclines and Herceptin with cardiac dysfunction. And so there was a lot of resistance to being treated with chemotherapy.
Did she have personal experience with other people who'd gotten chemotherapy that she knew?
Well, she had some friends who had had chemotherapy, and like most people, she recognized that the side effects could be significant, and she was very concerned about that.
So, Cliff, this woman presents to you for a second opinion in terms of what to do about her adjuvant therapy. She comes in with a positive one. So how would you discuss the various options with her, including trastuzumab without chemotherapy?
So this is a tough case because the other big issue in this case is her age. And that's the dimension that is, I think, even more challenging than the ones that have been addressed, because all the trials enrolled very few patients above age 70. And I think the BCRG trial capped them at age 70.
Yeah, we capped them at age 70.
Right. And this is an issue because globally, at least when you go back to the overview analysis, the marginal benefit of any chemo versus none in women above age 70 is not established. I hasten to add, I believe there's a benefit. But it's not established for a variety of reasons, largely that the impact is somewhat modest, clouded by the ER status and hormone therapy benefit in that age group, and lastly, because the numbers of patients ever randomized in that age group are relatively small. So the problem I have with the case is I don't know what's leading the decision. Based on a HER2-positive, node-positive breast cancer, independent of ER status, I would go for an anthracycline and taxane-based adjuvant therapy regimen, and that's what I would tell her to get. And she would have been eligible based on that for any of the trials. The dilemma is her age, and I'm not sure she's wrong to essentially insist on an aromatase inhibitor and trastuzumab. We don't have any data for that at all. But the marginal contribution of the chemotherapy to her outcome in this setting is speculative. And so there is absolutely no data that allows us to address what's best for her right now.
Have you treated any patients with adjuvant trastuzumab without chemo, Cliff?
I have not. But if there was ever a case where I'd be tempted to, it would be in a patient with a high degree of ER positivity who's older in age and has HER2-positive disease. And it's a desperately needed little bit of data that would fill in an important gap. And I think, frankly, if you back up even a half step and look at what we see with the trastuzumab is a remarkably consistent impact when you put trastuzumab on, and it raises the question of the contribution of the chemotherapy.
John, how would you have thought through this case?
We don't have good evidence that chemotherapy is warranted because of her age. We have no evidence that trastuzumab is beneficial in the absence of chemotherapy. I would hope that this question might be enlightened somewhat by a trial that you'll be hearing about soon called the TANDEM study. And it's a study in metastatic breast cancer. Unfortunately, it's a metastatic study where women with the ER-positive, HER2-positive disease all received anastrozole. Half of them were randomized to trastuzumab. Now, we're waiting for three more events to do the analysis. So we expect the answer in 2006, but it might inform this discussion to say, well, there's nothing added with trastuzumab to an AI, or at least answer the question that there is something additional to the addition of trastuzumab to an AI.
Bottom line, John, what do you think you would have recommended to her?
Well, if she had $45,000 Canadian dollars in her back pocket and very much wished to proceed with this, we could get her the treatment with an AI plus Herceptin off of trial. In Canada. In Canada, we only fund what's been proven by phase three studies, so she would not be eligible for the public funding for this. At the end of the day, I would still monitor her cardiac function as if she had received chemotherapy, and I guess we would just see what happened.
Going back to the TOPO2 data, which was so fascinating, one of the most interesting things that happened at this past San Antonio meeting. So, Cliff, again, I hear you saying you don't order it, but would you pay attention to it? Would you consider it if it had been done?
Well, I guess I don't know in what dimension you're asking, since my default, if I was going to give chemo, is to include the anthracycline anyway.
If her TOPO2 was low?
I think that you have to regard that analysis as interesting and provocative, but not definitive yet, and I would not be prepared on a routine basis to omit it. On the other hand, to omit the anthracycline. On the other hand, for a patient with an elevated cardiac risk and a HER2-positive tumor, certainly finding a lack of amplification would reassure me that carbo-docetaxel and trastuzumab is a great choice for her, although I would probably choose it even if I didn't know the TOPO status based on the cardiac risk.
John, what do you think? Is TOPO2 ready for prime time?
I don't think so yet, although the data is suggesting that we may have a third predictive assay finally in breast cancer. We have ER to tell us whether we should be using hormonal therapy. We have HER2 to tell us whether we need trastuzumab. I think that my prediction is that TOPO2 amplification will become a validated predictive assay for the benefit from anthracyclines. However, we haven't proven that yet. We have a 2,000-patient subgroup of a 3,000-patient trial analyzed now, and I would like to see more events with the analysis that's going to happen in 2007, the first quarter of 2007, with the full 3,000-patient trial population analyzed before I could say that we have made that point.
Same question I asked Cliff. Have you treated any patients with adjuvant trastuzumab without chemotherapy?
I have done so once, probably against my better judgment and against my recommendation, but the patient insisted, and it was the wife of a colleague who was a radiologist, so money was no issue.
Okay, well, Dr. Dragan, can you follow up on what happened to this woman?
Well, my thinking was very much in line with what Cliff and John had mentioned, and what we discussed was based on the experience to date at this point, demonstrating that a taxane with Herceptin in the metastatic setting was better than single-agent Herceptin. And so I convinced her to consider trying weekly Taxol and Herceptin followed by an AI, which she, based on my reassurance that this would not be a difficult thing, was accepting and willing to do. So we started weekly Taxol, and much to my chagrin, within 4 weeks, she had developed really significant hypersensitivity problems with a skin rash, fever, and pulmonary symptoms. And it needed to be treated with steroids, and I had to stop the Taxol. And we then continued on with the Herceptin alone with Arimidex.
So how's she doing at this point?
Well, she feels very well. I mean, she's asymptomatic. It took 2 to 3 weeks to resolve her hypersensitivity reaction. But once that resolved, of course, she lost her hair. And that's, of course, growing back. But she's doing very well on just the Herceptin and the Arimidex.
Cliff, any comments?
No, actually, I was just thinking as you said that, that indeed for lower risk patients in the intergroup, there is a randomized trial that she would have been eligible for that pits AC alone versus paclitaxel alone. It's not weekly. It happens to be Q2, but the concept's not so different. And for older patients, the marginal benefit of chemotherapy may be modest enough that it doesn't matter what you give, if you give anything. Similarly, for patients over 65, you know, we're studying capecitabine as a single agent. Right. And I think if you're going to go outside the bounds of standard therapy, essentially all options were up there, and I guess that could have been another one.
John?
Well, I agree. We're skating on thin ice. As a Canadian, I'm particularly sensitive to that. And I think that we're in a situation where, in the absence of evidence, if something goes wrong, we can always be held to account with criticism from our colleagues as to why we bothered in the absence of proven benefit. So I don't disagree with anything that was done. It's a difficult situation we all face, and unfortunately, we don't have trials to answer all of these questions. And then I think we have to fall back on very good communication and very good documentation of the discussions when you enter into something that is not evidence-based.
John, you mentioned an example of a small node-negative ER-positive tumor, and I was wondering if you thought about using Oncotype DX to help you in any of this thought process.
I think it's a reasonable question. The Oncotype DX can help define the populations who appear to benefit the most from chemotherapy, and it's particularly useful in the node-negative ER-positive population to help define that. You can argue as to how well-validated this study actually is. It came from a very nice clinical trial, and it certainly has provided very good information from that trial. Attempts to replicate it have met with variable success. One has been very clearly positive. There's another replication-type effort that did not give such a clean signal. At the end of the day, we are thinking in Canada, and we've had a technology assessment panel convened to address these issues, that the Oncotype DX test is driven in large part by HER2 status and ER positivity, or hormone receptor status. And we're hoping, because of our pocketbooks in part, that a very good assessment of hormonal receptor status with quantitative assessment as opposed to qualitative, plus a good quantitative assessment of HER2 status by FISH, could provide a cheaper alternative for at least the majority of that information. So in our practice, we don't tend to use that, nor are we intending to take our tumor blocks from the 006 study and actually ship them out for that testing. We have other analyses planned which are along similar lines, however.
Alan?
Yes, Dr. Mackey had mentioned the issue of funding in Canada, and there was this trial presented at San Antonio, a Finnish study, where I think they used a shorter course of Herceptin. Is this something that you might consider in Canada?
Well, the FinHER trial was a really interesting study. It was about 1,000 Finnish patients, and then the 20% of them that were actually HER2 positive, and I think the number was 232, were randomized to a Herceptin-based regimen or not. And there were two possible chemo combinations, one was docetaxel and one was vinorelbine. It is a 9-week exposure to trastuzumab as opposed to a 52-week. So I think it works out to about 7,000 Canadian pesos to treat such patients. And it does look like the magnitude of the effect was approximately the same as seen with other trials if you combine it with docetaxel. Now, the problem is it's such a tiny trial with only 200 patients that we can't be comfortable that we know the true safety signal, and we can't be comfortable that the efficacy signal is as real as it might appear. It has a p-value, 0.01 for disease-free survival, but we're looking at really robust data with other regimens. So we think that it would warrant a study of short versus long-term trastuzumab. I think that's its biggest signal. I don't believe anyone will be adopting that as the standard of care.
And I think also it's interesting, the BCRG study being more than 3,000 patients, trying to tell the difference between two effective trastuzumab studies. You couldn't even see it there. Now we're trying to make an indirect comparison to a study with way fewer patients. Dr. Kuser?
My question is about the TOPO2 test. Is it available commercially, and how expensive is it?
John?
TOPO2 had been available in several kits. I think there were three kits that had been available for laboratory usage. They're not FDA approved, but nonetheless, I think what is going to happen is some smart person, probably from Visus, is going to come up with a kit that does both your HER2 and your TOPO2 at the same time with different colors. So you'd have the Centromere 17, you'd have HER2 and TOPO2, and presumably that kit will be available soon. I personally do not routinely order the test. I think this data is sufficiently preliminary that I'm not using it to make clinical decisions yet. I'd like to see it validated in larger sets. So I can't tell you the cost because I haven't ordered it myself.
You know, I can't help but just point out that topoisomerase has been looked at in other studies and has not delivered the same clean signal. in a study of dose escalation of doxorubicin, which is not the same question as to whether you should get it or not, but in a study of dose escalation, topoisomerase inhibitor levels were not associated with the benefit for the higher dose anthracycline, for example. So I just think I'm underscoring John's point that we do need to see some independent corroboration of this.